This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, here we are. We are returning to a recurrent theme on The Think Tank. Our politics. How have they evolved? How are they messed up? Ultimately, how do you fix them? But how's it different? And essentially, we've had a number of elected and other officials on this show over the last couple of years and thrown out these kind of questions. And it's sort of like the blind man and the elephant. If you want to know what the animal is, you can't do it from the perspective of just one person. You need somebody who's had a variety. You need a lot of people that have had a lot of different perspectives. And our guest is somebody who's been around for a lot of what's happened in this state over the last 30 and 40 years. Jack Lunsford was the youngest elected county assessor in Arizona history. He won election. He also lost an election for county supervisor. He did government relations for the Community College District for, 20 plus years?
20 years.
20 years. And in that capacity, dealt with legislators, elected officials, governors, and others. He's been on the board of Westmac, which I don't know. I want to say Westmark, where I know you were the executive director of Westmark, which is the West Valley analog to the East Valley Partnership, which is really I'd call it a coalition of business and community interest on the West Side.
Business, right? Community, and education interests were all together. At Westmark when it was formed, and we pulled everybody together and advocated for good, strong public policy in the West Valley and in the state.
And really, interestingly, for somebody like myself, okay, I was on the East Valley Partnership board, and I was amused to find out it was kind of like, hey, Thomas on the Supreme Court, like Scalia said, is like the East Valley got the superstition freeway and a lot of other stuff, and I think the West Valley said, hey, we on our piece, right?
Well, and there was a point in time when the East Valley Partnership was not as prominent, and it was before I was CEO of Westmark, and I saw a clipping in the Arizona Republic which talked about East Valley Partnership was quoted as saying, we want to be like Westmark. I immediately sent that over to Westmark. that's been a wonder. It's not a rivalry. It is at times because we were both advocating for economic development and transportation and good education. But in issues of regional significance, we were together.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's a greater gain for the great. If we're talking about a major relocation into the valley from somewhere else, the first question is, did they come to the Phoenix metro area?
Saying
any company. The first thing is, are they coming to Metro Phoenix somewhere?
Sure.
And then a secondary question is, all right, where on point number two, we might have you might have some inter-valley. By the way, how do you feel about that? The suggestion that the name Valley of the Sun just doesn't resonate with the rest. Nobody outside of Phoenix knows what that is.
Well, I think it's because we've never really promoted it, number one. But number two, it's interesting that the East Valley Partnership changed their tagline to include the East Valley and Phoenix.
Yes,
there's a slash or a hyphen
right.
in there because they recognized nobody else outside knew about the East Valley.
In Arizona, East Valley works. But when you truck it back to New York, it's sort of East Valley of what?
Yeah. And the same for Westmark, the West Valley. So because it was originally the Western Maricopa Alliance.
Yeah. And where's Maricopa
like
for that matter?
Come on.
Yeah.
Maricopa is not a name that when you go to New York, they instantly gravitate the way they would to Greater Phoenix, for example.
Exactly. But I want to tell you both. Thanks for the opportunity to be here. Really going to be a fun thing for me.
So let me take us back.
Hold on a second. I want to go back to West Side. Hold on.
Okay.
I want to go back to the West because I'm a West Side guy. I love the West Side. You talk about West Side. I'm West Side's the best side.
Are you
in my
Avondale?
I'm in Goodyear.
I knew you were one of those.
I am a West Side guy. So when we talk about the East Valley and the West Valley, they're still within the citizenry. There's mm-hmm. almost a battle, a civil war there. Oh, mm-hmm. you're a West, you're an Avenue guy, you're a street guy. You know, it's that type of thing. It seems to us in the West Valley, seems the East Valley got the lion's share of everything. Are we just behind the times? Is it coming? What's exciting about the West Valley for us?
Well, let me answer your first question, which is, are we behind the times? I would suggest that maybe as much as 20 years, where the West Valley is that far behind the East Valley. Why? Mm-hmm. Because it was easier to coalesce at the time, Mesa, the big dog, and Chandler Gilbert at the time, the littler ones. There was no, we didn't have to worry about Higley or Queen Creek or anything else. And so you could coalesce that, move it quickly. Bob Evans, Chuck Walheim, those guys in the East Valley, boom. And they recognized that as Mike just said, you know, the Superstition Freeway, boom, was going to drive everything.
That was the number one accomplishment.
Absolutely.
Build the Superstition Freeway.
Absolutely. Yep. And that was the drive and the focus. For the West Valley, how do you coalesce 12 individual cities ranging in population from 4,000 to 225,000 today? And, oh, by the way, the West Valley includes West Phoenix, which is somewhere near half a million people. So how do you pull that together in a single voice? So I was one of the founders of Westmark. We weren't able to do that until 88, because we had multiple voices speaking. So, okay. And the second part of your question, Mike, is where are we today? I think still the West Valley needs to have some zoning changes. So if you look at those cross streets right by a freeway exit where three of them are zoned commercial, or excuse me, three of them are zoned retail and one commercial, I think we may have that a little backwards.
Sure.
Because it does, you know, I understand the drive and the need for retail because that gives you sales tax so you can grow. But commercial is going to be more sustainable in the long term.
Commercial is primary industry, right? That's money coming into the community as opposed to circulating within it.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. So let's do this. When we come back, and Doc, I interrupted your question. I'm going to get to your question when we come back. More with Jack Lunsford right here in the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we're back with Jack Lunsford, longtime political operative, government relations representative for the community. You've been at the table at a lot of the biggest decisions in this community over the last 30 plus years. Tell me what you think the biggest changes you've seen in how we operate as a body politic over the last 30 plus years.
I think two things off the top of my head, Mike. Term limits, and we can talk about that and expand on that. So we've taken people who have little or no experience, and at the end of their first term, by the time they're in their second term, they're a committee chair, and or in leadership. They don't have any foundation, basis, institutional knowledge, etc. Term limits has been a big problem. And I think second of all, as we've moved to the ideology of folks, and it started back after President Reagan was elected and then out of office, and there were a lot of those folks who espoused selected portions of his agenda about limited government and free enterprise, but that ideology continued to move to the right. I would say the third thing I just in thinking is there's really, to me, a lack of collegiality. So in my first actually gig was in 78 when we were trying to get certification passed for assessor personnel. There was no requirement for someone who went out and valued your house for tax purposes to have any education and training whatsoever. We moved that forward, and we were able to do that in a very strong bipartisan way. There were a lot of bipartisan things. There were people like John Cromco from Tucson, who was as far left as you could get, and Jim Skelly from Central Phoenix, who at the time Northeast Phoenix, but essentially Central Phoenix, and Jim was very, very conservative. Sometimes people would go and sit in the gallery, the lobbyists would, to watch the debate between Cromco and Skelly. And yet at the end of the debate session, the caucus or committee of the whole, they'd go out and have a burger or a beer or whatever. Jim Skelly was very, very good friends with Art Hamilton, extremely well thought of leader in the state.
Democratic leader.
Democratic leader, who never got his due, by the way. He was president of the National Conference of State Legislatures, a minority person, African-American, a Democrat from Arizona. And I don't think we ever gave Art the due that he deserved. And he was a great compromiser. So you
had a great story. The Art Hamilton story. Gets elected. And he's too young to serve. He has to sit in the gallery for a month.
Yes. Yeah. He was not eligible because he was too young. Age 25 is the stipulation. But there was Art Hamilton and Alfredo Gutierrez, both Democrats, one in the House, one in the Senate, and Burton Barr, and
Republican majority leader,
and probably more so, like Speaker, Majority Leader, and Whip all in one. Burt was incredible.
Associate Governor.
Exactly. Lieutenant Governor Burt Barr. And there were times when even the Republicans didn't have enough of their votes in the House. And the old story was that Burt would have to go shop at Alfredo's store.
Which is, we've had Alfredo in here, and I just, that's my favorite phrase in political lexicon.
Absolutely. But really, I think the collegiality,
You always had this sense these guys worked together.
They did for the good of the state, not for the good of the ideology, not for the good of the party, but for the good of the state of Arizona. And I've been doing this almost 35 years. You had Bruce Babbitt, who decided that groundwater was a major issue in the state of Arizona and pulled together lobbyists and legislators and experts and researchers and said, we're going to fix this problem. And it's the model groundwater code for the country.
And if you don't think that's significant, take a look at California that is drying up before our very eyes.
And they don't have a model groundwater code, which they could have, for some reason, ever since the 80s, whatever has happened in California has blown over to Arizona. They had the opportunity to take it back over there, and they didn't do it.
We had Jack August in here, the historian, and asked him, who do you think the best governor Arizona ever had? His answer was Bruce Babbitt, and the reason was the groundwater code.
Yes, absolutely.
We're in the desert, and we have more assured water resources than the state of California.
From my time in real estate, that was what we talked about. We had investors coming over from different. Well, you're in the desert. How do you have any water? And I got to tell that story over and over again, and I would bubble up when I got to talk about it because it was just it's an area of pride, I think, for the state of Arizona. We like you said, we became a model for the rest of the country.
I can also tell you, we don't have time in these segments for all the stories, but I will tell you that certain bills would come to the floor in the House, whether it was Martin Luther King holiday or groundwater code or whatever, and lobbyists would go into the gallery because they knew Art Hamilton was going to speak on the floor in the debate. And it was like it was worth the admission to go there because you would see a statesman who was articulate and who would help lead the debate in a bipartisan way. And we don't have bipartisanship. This notion that we have to adopt a budget with only one party's votes. And that happened in the early 90s because the Democrats hadn't been in power and they wanted it. And so they did Democrat votes. We do that. There's no reason in this state, and I'm a native, that we should have a budget that is adopted by only one party.
Just the arithmetic on that. If you have, say, 60-40 Republican-Democrat, what that says is that we have this peculiar minority rule because 60%, you need a majority of the 60%. So if you have 31% out of 60, 31-29. That means that the 31% of the legislature controls the legislature.
Absolutely.
Not 51, 31.
And I'm going to say something that's somewhat heresy, especially to the people who want sunshine in government. And I firmly believe in that, except for in the budget caucuses. I think we ought to allow closed caucuses for budget discussions, because what we have done in having open caucus for budget discussions, nobody is open. And so the conversations happen in what they call now the small group meetings. So you guys would be called into a small group meeting with me as the majority leader, and I would say, what do you need in order to be on the budget? And you would tell me, and I'd mark it down, and we'd go, good. And then I go to the next one. And the next one may not know what you need, and I may not relay what you need. Mm-hmm. And so now we've got these small group meetings that happen that don't lead themselves to open conversation about the good of Arizona and the budget. And that it's heresy, but I believe we need to go back to it.
That's pulling back the curtain right there. And that's why we have Jack Lunsford with us today. And I'll tell you, if it had to do with anything Arizona politics in the last 30 years, this man probably had his hand in it, or he had a front row seat to it. So we are going to continue to pick his brain. We're going to talk about really a little bit more about what's wrong, a little bit more about how to fix it when we come back on The Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, our guest is Jack Lunsford, heretic.
Wow.
He wants... This is total heresy. His solution to he basically wants to undo things that were put in as reforms, right? We put in, open caucuses so we get to see everything's going. And the other biggie, that you're going to have to convince the world on this one. Term limits are a bad idea. Term limits was one of the most popular reforms ever put into government. Tell us why it's a bad idea.
I didn't favor it when it was proposed. I'm still opposed to it, and I'll tell you why. So you have legislators who are limited to 8 years, and unless you
go— Of course,
go,
then they switch houses.
I was just going to say there was a recent agreement on a trade between Senator Schumer and Representative Montenegro. But I opposed it because all term limits did was empower lobbyists and staff, because they're not subject to term limits.
They're the institutional history.
Absolutely. And that can be, depending on who is conveying it, maybe a little bit distorted at times. I remember a committee that I was in, and Pat Wright, who's no longer in the legislature, she was a wonderful legislator, and somebody was testifying about a particular issue, and Pat said, you know, I think we talked about that about 12 years ago. She goes, and it was bad then, and it's bad now. And we don't have that institutional memory because of term limits. Mm. We also, as a result—
Do you think we'd have different people in the legislature?
I do.
Who do you think would have kept that we lost?
Jack Brown.
Mm-hmm.
A conservative rural Democrat who had been in the legislature, got out, and came back. Jack was a wonderful, wonderful legislator. On the Republican side, question is, would Jane Hull have moved towards Secretary of State and become governor? I don't know.
Possibly not.
Sue Gerard. Mm-hmm. A moderate Republican from Central Phoenix who knew healthcare upside down and sideways, and one of the best policy people on healthcare reform and insurance.
You've mentioned two endangered species, conservative Democrats and moderate Republicans. It's been a long time since I've seen one of those.
Yeah, it's a long time since it's been mentioned, I think. We don't mention them. So I think those kinds of things. Now, there are people who say, well, clean elections, made that change. I think clean elections has probably balanced what we have now and balanced off of term limits, because it has allowed people.
You know, there's one thing I really want to ask you. I look at the evolution of our state politics. I see the near withdrawal of major business influences from the political processes.
Absolutely.
And there's like no GPL, Greater Phoenix Leadership, the old Phoenix 40, that used to be overly engaged, now seems to be completely withdrawn from the process.
Well, and I think in their case and in the cases of others where the organizations got bigger, it was more difficult to then iris down and say, okay, here's the powerful leadership, and you know, they're going to help drive this public policy. Last time GPL really did, they did All Day K, they did ASU downtown with some bonding, and they did the convention center. Yeah.
They did step in on the discrimination ordinance, but it was very much after the fact. It was like, oh, my God, look what they did. We've got to jump in on this.
Exactly. Exactly. I just heard an interview on this station with someone about business needs to stand up. And because education is important to educate economic development. And one of the things we're going to support is the proposal by Governor Ducey. And I thought that that was an interesting thing because I have my own thoughts on that proposal.
Well, what do you think? The governor took aside a number of major business leaders and threatened them and said, thou better not support a proposal to increase the sales tax to fund education.
I was not in that room, but I have talked to several people who were, and you get various perspectives. Some said, well, I didn't feel threatened. And some said, absolutely, we were threatened. So it was just all how the message was received. But I think the general consensus of the public is that the threat was there.
Okay.
What is your impression about—
We have to back up. Just one second. We have to back up because we went to term limits and then we jumped to the Phoenix 40 and then it turned into no corporate participation. If you're going to talk about term limits, and we can tie a bow around that, but the term limits, understand that I think, because you're talking about congressional memory, historic memory, and it's lost when you term out. Is there a middle ground where term limits, the terms could just be upped, expanded? It could go to 4 or 5 terms and then out? Do you see, or just infinitely, you can retire, you can start as a representative and retire as a representative?
Several questions there, Mike. First of all, is there a middle ground? I'd given that some thought as an alternative, being a lobbyist. Part of what I do is compromise. Mm-hmm. And back when the proposal was there, I thought, well, maybe there is some compromise. I'm just not convinced that there is. So I know that there are groups of people who don't want career politicians. Well, the way we do that is the ballot box. And we do that every 2 years. Mm-hmm. And if we have participation rates like we do in this state for voting, then I don't think we're going to vote people out who are problems. Second of all, a lot of that is controlled at the precinct level. There was a guy on my board, I won't name him, at Westmark, a fiscal conservative, businessman. I wouldn't call him a social liberal, but he was not as conservative socially. On a school board whose wife was a teacher, he would go into his precinct committee meetings. And it was almost like he didn't have a chance. I think he's run 3 times. The best he's finished is 3rd. Mm. This is a guy who would be a good legislator. So what's happened in the precincts is a lot of the people are extreme on both sides, whether you go into the Democrats or the Republicans. Both sides, they're the extreme. They're the activists. And you have to get those people behind you in order to have a chance to get elected. So there's another area where— you know, that's voter participation. Nobody knows about precinct committees, and then we check them
off.
But
they run the parties.
They do run the parties. Absolutely.
And this is a handful of people.
Yeah.
Who show up at these things, basically determine what our parties stand for.
So will open primaries change that? or open primaries, or, you know, top two or top four in the House of Representatives, there's a good possibility. I don't think our public is ready for just having the names without party affiliation.
Sure.
But I think there's room for that. We've tried everything else. We've tried clean elections. I was involved in not the campaign finance reform, but the lobbyist registration reform, which I believe was necessary. In the changes where we've gone to, you know, no gifts to legislators, and, you know, I will tell you, if I bought a legislator a lunch back in the day, that wasn't guaranteeing me anything but a conversation.
Mm-hmm. But a campaign contribution, those are bigger figures.
Unless you're a public sector lobbyist like I was,
own. You can't.
Well,
absolutely.
I did, and it was my own money. Mm-hmm. You know, but I did that in order to play. So, you know, campaign contributions are part of it too.
Yeah, I got to know one thing. It's a follow up on what you were saying before. The meeting with Ducey business community. Don't you dare, you know, set up an initiative to fund education. What was the reaction of the business community to that suggestion?
We are going to hold that answer till after the break. More with Jack Lunsford when we come back, right here in the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, Jack Lunsford, I threw out a question that you didn't have a chance to answer. And just to recall, it's basically the meeting between the governor and the business community where he basically said something to the degree of threat we could, you know, I guess there are different views on that. But he basically said, do not set up an initiative to fund education behind my back. And I'm curious as to how that went over in the business community.
Well, I don't have any firsthand knowledge. But my speculation is this: the results speak for themselves. The business community has not moved forward with any initiative. There is strong support from certain business leaderships, Arizona Chamber of Commerce being one. I think there's some tacit support
for
his proposal to provide funding to K-12 education from the state trust land fund. I just came from a meeting and talked with someone who's involved in both education and a longtime business guy and a lobbyist who has real questions about it, because down the road we're going to create not a cliff. I think it's even deeper. I think it's a crevasse. You know, the proposal is we're going to give you $10 billion a year for 5 years, and then we're going to ratchet it down to five. And at the end of that, we're going to go to zero from that funding source. And trust me, the legislature is going to backfill that.
Ooh.
Wow, okay,
that's what, I mean, I see yeah, this
now,
as a
I now. That
that's what's not been
said. The icy crevasse.
Yeah, that's not what's been said. Trust me, the legislature is going to backfill it. But that's the inference.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see the analogy of this is you've got the state land trust that basically is a state asset,
owned by education.
Right, and education gets to take a little bit out of it every year. And like any endowment, the principle in an endowment, like a university endowment, is you don't touch the principal, you get the interest, and that you have that in perpetuity, that's yours forever. If you start taking away the principal, then eventually the thing goes away.
Exactly.
And I think this suggestion is, let's start nibbling at the principal a little bit, because we don't have much money now. And it doesn't answer the question of what happens on the back end. Because you're not going to have the principal. The principal will wither away. The revenue stream will either go away or diminish, depending on how much you take. Then it's the what happens. And from the governor's perspective, it seems to me the answer is, well, I'm not in office then.
Exactly. And it's estimated to be $300 per student. So will that raise us from 49th to 48th or from 49th to 47th? I'm not sure. But it's not an increment that is worth, to me, to worth A, eroding the principal, and B, setting school districts up like they are with overrides. The reason we have overrides, and I've heard you guys talk about overrides before, Mike, we have overrides because we haven't fully funded education, but overrides last for 7 years. School districts have to reauthorize at the fourth year. If they don't, the fifth year, they lose a third of the override that had been previously authorized. The second year, they lose another third. And the third year, they're back to zero. That's why they have to reauthorize that. Otherwise, they go back to a base from 8-10 years ago.
And this is your area of expertise. Let me give you my understanding of why you have overrides. Essentially, and tell me if I got it right. The legislature limits how much a school board can raise, and it sets a limit on that. And it says, you've got taxing authority, but only up to this level. And that level is way below the level that most districts need to operate. And the only way they can increase it is by periodically going back to voters and saying, we want more money for this, we want more money for this. Is that a fair statement of what?
That's pretty close. Because the other element that comes into play, and this is a result of Roosevelt versus Bishop, where we were just going to have equalized school districts, and several of the wealthier school districts went, oh, wait a minute. If our citizens want to raise more money, we ought to be allowed to do that. That's why we've continued to that, and now we've created that imbalance again. So you have wealthier school districts who can have more money because the citizens go and pay for a bond election for their students because they afford it.
And the phony argument is, yes, well, but the parents in Paradise Valley care more about their schools.
Well, that's certainly the argument that's put forward.
It's a lot less painful for them to raise the level.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, you know, it's a treadmill. I wouldn't even call it a treadmill. I think it's the hamster wheel, you know, that as long as you reauthorize the override, the school district will be the same. When the hamster gets off the wheel stops.
Sure.
And now all of a sudden that school district doesn't go back 4 years because maybe they've reauthorized the override for the last three election cycles. Now all of a sudden they drop back 12 years.
And what they face is the voters, when they face that, you talk to the average voter, their perception is these schools, they are asking me for more money in every single election.
Mm-hmm. And that's from a parent, right. West Valley guy, from a parent. And I show up with the two bags per classroom of supplies that we need for the classroom, those supplies I'm bringing. And then I look at, and I'm not going to name the district, but I look at a new school district with this Taj Mahal-esque building that a nice mid-sized business would be very proud to have. And then they're coming to me for more money. That's the way we see it as voters.
Because voters have a difficult time distinguishing between what's raised on a capital bond and what's raised on the maintenance and operating side. So the capital bond, if the school district is wealthy, they can say, you know, I'm going to have the posh gymnasium and the expanded auditorium and two stories and yada, yada, yada.
Dome stadium in one case.
You know, when you've got when your power plant is the single largest tax-paying entity in your district and the power plant doesn't vote, you can have one of those. But Robbie sure would love that, by the way, having played there. But anyway, so that's the difficulty that parents have. And if you're in the Dysart School District, okay, and your largest taxpayer group are the retirees from Sun City and Sun City West, and they've go, well, I already put my kids through school.
Sure, yeah.
You know,
been there, done that.
You know, somebody paid for them, their kids to go to school, but they don't think about that. And so, you know, they vote down overrides and so on. Well, what you finally have to have are the consequences. So what's Dysart doing? Dysart's now busing teachers, kindergarten teachers, because they don't have enough to make in one school or another, or no, excuse me, it's because they went to half-day kindergarten because they couldn't afford a full-day kindergarten. So they go half-day, and the teachers are teaching the first half of the day at this school, and then they're busing the teachers over to the second school for the second half. So I remember the Washington School District many, many years ago, and the school district board said if you don't pass the override, these are the consequences. We're going to cut A, B, C, D, and E. And, you know, there were two board members who campaigned against the override. They were negative votes on moving it forward. They campaigned against it. It failed. Well, the school district said, well, parents, we told you we were going to cut A, B, C, D, and E. Guess what? And they did. And the parents came out and went, why are you cutting, you know, music from or PE or whatever it was from my kids? Well, because we have to provide the essentials, you know, the basic education. Right. So we cut those things. So guess what happened? They went back for another bond override in the next election, and it passed 2-1.
Nice.
Because the parents understood what the consequences were. The district said, this is what we're going to do.
And I've seen the polling figures on education in the last 6 months, and I think there's been a revolution. It is off the charts mm-hmm. concern for education, because I think the degree of cuts have been for long enough that they've come home.
We got to understand it. We got a minute and a half. You wanted some stories.
Oh, yeah.
You wanted a story.
Yeah, this is radio. You can't do it. You have this interesting thing. You're a dead ringer for Bill Clinton. Tell us a funny story.
Well, first of all, I'll be able to tell you this. I have better taste in women than he does. But my story is, one of my stories, when he was running for president for the very first time, he was governor of Arkansas, and I'd been told I looked like him. So I went up to him at a conference. They were getting ready for a debate, and I said, excuse me, Governor. I said, I've been told we look alike. I said, I just want to introduce myself and see. And he was talking to somebody else, and he kind of turned his head like he was going to shine me on, and he looked, and all of a sudden he goes, yeah, we do, don't we? You know? And so I had that. I had the, here's a great irony. I was at another conference in New Orleans where some guys were going, hey, would you take your picture with my wife?
Oh, that's funny.
Absolutely, I will.
And you've cultivated the Arkansas accent.
I did a commercial years ago, and I couldn't do his voice.
Yeah.
So I had to learn to do it.
Nice. This is actually, this music you're hearing, this is Doc O'Neill original, by the way. He did. This is his music. Yeah.
Go to michaelneal.org. There's a little musical note down at the bottom. You can click on it and hear the story and download the music.
Jack Lunsford, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for spending some time with us right here on the Think Tank, KTAR News.